No one plans for hair loss, but through Hims, you can take the next step with confidence. Access treatments made with clinically proven ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil to stop hair loss and regrow hair in 3 to 6 months. No waiting rooms, no hoops, just ingredients with a track record of results. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hims brings expert care straight to you, with 100% online access to personalized treatments that put your goals first. For simple online access to personalized and affordable care for hair loss, ED, weight loss, and more, visit hims.com/Hail Mary. That's hims.com/Hail Mary for your free online visit. hims.com/Hail Mary. Individual results may vary, based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Prescription required. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and welcome to part two of the defensive discussion of that game against the Browns. And we're going to talk about an awful lot of fun stuff that happened in this game. And joining me to do that is my friend Jordan Coe. Jordan, how you doing?
Good, Ken. Glad to be back.
It's always a pleasure to talk football with you. Part one, I really enjoyed lots of very organic, terrific discussion about, you know, whether or not the Ravens are really open to rotation when they've shown, and at guard is you know, where Jordan thinks it could occur. And I made the point that I think the Ravens have shown an openness to rotation over the last several years. That's fairly undeniable. Jordan said he didn't really want to rotate the current guys, but I'll let you, what was your reaction to that at guard? You want to go out and get somebody better.
Well, I mean, if they decided to rotate a guard because they thought it was worthwhile, I think it's worth a look. If we're hearing from the coaches, what we got is not worth it, this ain't it, then I get it, right? And maybe that's, you know, the Ravens are never going to answer these questions. These people, there are too many people that are critical of John Harbaugh and how he answers questions to reporters. And it just, I just can't wrap my head around this idea that anybody takes anything that he says in any press conference, in any instance, seriously, and thinks that there's anything that they can glean from that. But we can glean from what they do with these rotations, what they do with the players. They're telling us that they don't think that anybody else is worth putting on the field, whether it's for developmental reasons, whether it's for performance reasons. I think that a lot of people think that the miss at the trade deadline was another elite defender. I think the miss at the trade deadline was adding another guy to the guard mix.
Okay. And it would have had come with a cost. They would have had to figure out how to make the roster spot, which means someone would have had to be cut. And that could have been a tough cut. It might not have even been an offensive lineman, because I guess they could have and added a 10th offensive lineman, but then they would have cut somewhere else. You know, do you cut Ali, who might be the next guy who gets cut on the offensive side? So yeah, I mean, feelings are well known on that topic.
The only thing I would say about this too, Ken, is like a guy like Cesar Ruiz, you might not think he's elite. I think he's slightly above average. He's a guy who can also play center. And I think that the Ravens simultaneously could have potentially given themselves an out to not being a hostage in the Linderbaum situation by adding a guy like that. Even if you went back to Voorhees and Polele at guard in the upcoming year. So it could have been a two birds, one stone type situation for the right guy. Now, New Orleans might not have been interested. It might not have been worth the draft pick cost that was going to be. He came with, I think, a 10 plus million cap number. So yeah, it wasn't free. I mean, the Ravens cap situation is great headed into next year. There's nothing to complain about the Ravens cap situation.
Other than they have all these players to sign. You've got to be joking.
They have three players to sign. They have 49 already on the cap. They've got 12 in carryover, and they've got a restructure from Lamar that they could do at any time. The Ravens could be sitting on $70 million in cap space going into next year.
This is the problem that they don't know is they don't know if they can get that restructure done with Lamar, and they have to.
They don't know that they can get an extension done, but I'm sure that Lamar would be happy to take his money now. Like, they can get a restructure done. They can create cap space into next year if they had to. No one turns down a restructure.
No, they can't turn down a restructure. I mean, if it's a simple restructure, there may already be language in their contract, which doesn't allow them to do it, doesn't allow them to say no to it. But what it does do is put you in a weaker position in terms of sure. negotiating that extension.
I prefer an extension. But look, even if you extended Linderbaum, Likely, and Travis Jones, with the way that these contracts work, the three of those guys could occupy $38 million in a cap hit on the first year of their deals. And that would not be unreasonable.
No, it wouldn't be unreasonable. And that would be, but the problem so is what it would be in years 2 and 3 and 4. It's not a one-dimensional problem.
I mean, the years 2, 3, and 4 are also just fine for the Ravens. Roquan will be gone by year 2 of that deal, and a ton of cap space will come open at that point. Like, at this phase, with the way Keon's playing, Humphrey probably gone at that point. Yeah. So, like, as long as they don't retain Andrews, and again, this is an assumption that they don't try and retain Andrews. If Andrews, Humphrey, and Roquan Smith are all gone by year 2 of, like, or by 2027, the cap is fine.
Topic for another show. I definitely was not in favor of spending a lot of what would be additional 25, 26 cap space this year. So I wasn't excited about that. And, you know, the other thing is, same problem as we talked about in the first show, is that I'm not shooting for the freaking middle of the league if I'm going to pay $10 million for it. You better give me a Roquan Smith level talent.
$10 million at guard is middle of the league. I mean, top of the league is getting like 18 plus.
I'm not denying it. I'm saying I need to get value on the dollars that I spend during this season. I need to get value for that. And I've got guards that are cheap and not terrible. And I've got to get guards that are distinctly better than that, and either not too much more money or a little bit better and just as cheap. I can do either of those, but I can.
You are like the one person in all of Baltimore that thinks that
I'm not the one.
The Ravens guard play is adequate.
I'm just one of the ones that's not vocal. There's a whole lot of people who say, listen to Ken, he knows what he's talking about.
I'm teasing you. You know I'm teasing you.
Yeah. But there's a dearth of people who understand the topic for multiple reasons. Some of it is podcasting, but a lot of it is just the platform Twitter. It's just too easy to cherry pick bad plays. For bad players. And you can't do that. You can't look at individual plays and say, I've got the whole picture here. It's complete freaking bullshit. Complete bullshit. All right. And the more the people do it, and you know, there's a gang on effect, and all the people want to talk about it. I mean, just take a look at the universe of plays that the guy puts out there. There are plenty of bad plays, by the way. It's not like there's a shortage of those, but the fact of the matter is they tend to be on lower leverage plays because they tend to be on run blocking. That Falele really looks like an idiot.
Yeah, I mean, I think Voorhees is a little bit more of, I think Voorhees in a like lack of pass blocking skill is a little bit more of the problem. Like, and the whiffs come in big moments from a pass blocking situation, and like they turn into absolute drive killers.
Okay, you're making me uncomfortable with a comment like that. That's generalized in nature. It's like saying the whiffs come in big moments. Any whiffs are bad, and they may be predictive of other whiffs that are going to occur. But the Voorhees has additional value. He has 2 years of team control remaining. There's no way they're giving up on someone like where at his current stage of taking off on the runway. I mean, he's at exactly the expected point for a guard at his stage of development.
But that's why I gave an example of a guy that gives you leverage over Linderbaum. If you don't want to pay Linderbaum $19 million AAV next year, and you have a guy like Ruiz whose signing bonus is obligated to the New Orleans Saints, and you have him at $10 million this year and $10 million next year, that gives you leverage to be able to utilize that, and then you can go right back to Falele and Voorhees at your guards the following year. So there are more options than just, I have to replace my guard this year, and I can't use him for anything else.
Well, Falele is gone at the end of this year. I think we'll basically agree with that. There will be a market for Falele outside of Baltimore. And will I think there? Yeah, there will be. Look, there was a market for John Simpson. How do you even explain that with the penalty totals he had and you know, I mean,
and McCarry, right? Well, yeah. I mean, but McCarry was, yeah, it's hard, this stuff, the Ravens problem with the offensive line is a lack of like raw consistent. Like, it's just someone is messing up They almost mess up like one out of every five times, and they like split the difference about who does it. Right. So you get an 80% value of consistency, but someone's screwing up way too consistent. Like someone, not picking any one guy, but someone is screwing up too often and is blowing up plays. And whether it's running or passing, that is the Ravens on second down are miserable. And some of that is the play calling. And
okay, I need to reel this in because we need to talk defense.
Yeah. Okay.
So we promised we'd come back in this and talk about the pass rush first. And the teaser was we're going to talk a little bit about the deception or through at Shedeur Sanders in the second half. Mostly it's at Shedeur Sanders. They blitz with an off-ball blitz. This is not a 5+ blitz, and there aren't definitions that go out there in both directions. We talked about 5+, they were very effective, 10 plays minus 25 yards with 5+. But they had 12 off-ball blitzes in the game. 4 of them were doubles, so they had 8 plays with a blitzer coming from off-ball. They got 6 pressures on those plays, they got 2 ball out quicks, and they got minus 25 net yards on those 8 plays, or minus 3.1 per play. With 2 sacks. So exciting blitz. I hope you're not just going to hand wave against that and talk about that. Maybe you can talk about some specific blitz and not just say it wasn't a good, it's just the Browns again.
No, I mean, the Ravens, not at all. The Ravens blitz packages were phenomenal. And the Ravens pressure rate, given talent quality, other than, you know, whether or not you want to trade Jones for OA and then adding Kyle Hamilton to the mix, the talent of their pass rush has not elevated significantly overall in a 4 or 5 man guy. And the quality of the rush that we're getting is just significantly better. Now, whether that's more stunts, whether that's better calls, whether that's better isolation and matchups, et cetera, they're doing it all a lot better. They use these off-ball blitzes to really create those mismatches. And they do it underneath in other spots. They show heavy on one side. They get the guys one-on-one where they want. They're getting those free rushers where they need them. It's kind of vintage Ravens off-ball blitzes that it felt like through the first 4 weeks, their off-ball blitzes were always getting picked up, that it was dead obvious where the guy was coming from and the guys that were going to blitz, even if there were extra guys in the line of scrimmage. And a lot of that has changed. And that, you know, for all of the criticism that you might want to give to the offensive line of the Browns, the one thing that they should be best at is identifying that kind of stuff, because you got a bunch of guys that played a long time. Yeah,
I agree. And I think some of the things they did to try and confuse the Browns were really done more to confuse Shedeur than they were to confuse the line. And that's not always the case. A lot of the times, you know, you try a lot of simulated pressure because you want to confuse the guys at the line of scrimmage. It's not necessarily going to confuse the quarterback. Maybe make the quarterback nervous, but it's to confuse the center on his line calls. It's to confuse the guys up front and make them mess up. But anyway, the Ravens had tremendous success with their off-ball blitzes, minus 3.1 yards per play. Remember that number. Stunts. Now, they hadn't been doing many stunts in recent weeks, and it's looked like Orr basically says, no more stunts on field. I'm calling them all from the sideline. They had 5 stunts in this game. That's right at a level where maybe they were allowed to call some stunts on the field, but most of them were probably called from the sideline as well. They had minus 3 net yards on those 5 stunts. And then they lost another 15 yards on an intentional grounding on one of the stunts. So they had minus 3.6 yards per play on those. These numbers, these are not ever seen numbers that you're negative on all of these things with any significant number. And 12 off-ball blitzes is a lot. Even 8 plays is a fair amount. 5 stunts is more than the Ravens have been having. But they got a sack, 2 ATSs, 1 ball out quick. And they just executed them with deadly precision. I thought the blitz from Simpson that got home on the intentional grounding. Simpson looked like the Tasmanian devil out there in this game.
Question. Do you know how many of the stunts included Draymond Jones?
Yes. Now, okay. Maybe not, because he might've been an under player, but as the looper, I could tell you it was Brian, then Green, then Van Noy. That was a beautiful one. Where it was a pick play.
That was a sack.
It was Van Noy was on the quarterback hit by 32 with the intentional grounding. Quarterback hit by Simpson. Then the stunt by, yeah, you're right. That's like a sack. And then a stunt by Simpson. I'm missing one, but those are the ones I can see right there.
Interesting.
Two by Simpson. I think I only said 1 by Simpson. So 2 by Simpson.
The reason I asked that question would be that I wouldn't have been surprised that they're stunting more now that Jones is here. He's a good fit to be able to do that. He can play a little bit more inside, so you can do a little bit more with him inside and outside. So that may be part of us starting to see some more stunts.
But they've been fearless about who they've been asking to be the pick player. So we may have seen Jones on some unders, and I didn't record him as such here. The guy I did notice and really, you know, showed up in a note big time was Kyle Hamilton. Set an incredible pick for Van Noy. I mean, incredible pick. He dove into the hole, and I think he picked up the running guard and maybe the running back and the center, and Van Noy just cruised by for one of the quickest QHs you'll see.
The best one that one of the great ones that he had was in the Chicago game too, where he stunted, blocked off the guard, confused the hell out of the running back in the process, and still got the quarterback sack.
He's an unbelievable athlete at times. It looks like he can have the leverage sometimes to push a tackle around. So you got that. Anyway, stunts, they minus 3.6 yards with the intentional grounding. Simulated pressure. Now, for starters, there's a lot of these have overlap with them. And it did so happen that one of the plays, and it happened to be a sack, was a simulated pressure with a stunt and a blitz. So it shows up in all three of these categories, and it was for minus 13 yards. Doesn't reduce the impressiveness. Seven simulated pressures, minus 25 yards, minus 3.6 yards per play, one interception, two sacks, three quarterback hits, one pressure, one ball out quick. They got one ball out quick. The whole time the Ravens tried these simulated pressures. And then two plus elements. They had six such plays. I'm just going to read them off to you. Sack minus 13, interception, sack minus 14, incomplete for minus 4.5 yards per play.
Just staggering overall numbers. staggering overall numbers. One of the things I feel like I mentioned this earlier. One of the things I feel like I've noticed them doing a bit more in some of these simulated pressures now are they're also having, it's not a in and out. It's not all seven guys line up and the four guys that are rushing rush immediately and the three guys that drop immediately. We're starting to see a couple guys start to look like they're coming in and then fading back on the play, back into the spots where some of these ball out quicks would go. We saw the one of the critical ones was in the Minnesota game where the corner on the left side of the field did that. McCarthy saw him coming, thought he was going to blitz past him, was going to throw it over him, and never got the window. And then all of a sudden, he's in hot trouble because they've got pressure coming from the other direction. That's also like vintage, right? Like Madden technique, right? Like you run a guy in enough to get the center or a guard or a tackle to respond to that player. And then you drop out of it before they even get a chance to engage. And I don't know if this is true or not. It feels like the Ravens are doing a little bit more with their deception.
They're definitely doing more with that, with simulated pressure and drops in the line of scrimmage. One of the things I really like to see from an interior guy is for him sometimes all he really has to do is put his hands up to draw that response you're talking about. But one thing you do is you get Travis Jones a single team on the inside. If you put your hands up opposite the center, if you put your hands up and you're Roquan Smith and you're right over the center or Kyle Hamilton, you can push up on that center and drop back into coverage more quickly, possibly. So there's a lot you can do with just being at the line of scrimmage that is more than just simple confusion. You may actually be able to create a single team by one of the guys who's there.
Yeah. And it feels like I just feel like again and it's not to, you know, overly criticize the first 4 weeks, but the first 4 or 5 weeks were really bad. All of them just felt really, everything felt prescribed. Everything felt clear about what was coming and what was happening. And it just is getting cloudier and cloudier, and they're mixing in more and more blitzes. And I'm tired of watching Chiefs games and hearing about how Steve Spagnuolo never runs the same blitz twice and all this jargon that is just patently untrue. But we are starting to see Zach Orr develop a bag. I think this was Wink Martindale's problem, was that eventually it just was some kind of cover zero blitz. And you knew that's what it was. And you might not know where the blitzer was coming, but what you really needed to do was ID the spot that you could throw over the top. And once you did that, or throw on the slant or whatever that was. And once you did that, you isolated and you could beat it. This feels much more complex when they are blitzing with that. And I mean, I like to see it. I think that when you don't have a great front four naturally, which the Ravens don't, and maybe Lawson, you know, I think Lawson's due to come in and he's going to be a situational pass rusher. They're going to use him that way. They're going to hope him and Jones.
Okay. What's your prediction on games for Lawson? Your over under that you would set for me to wager against. I'll take 11 to 10 on either side. I guarantee you
how many games I
on how many games you think Carl Lawson will play in the regular season, the remainder of this regular season.
I think we won't see him against the Jets. I think we might see him against Cincinnati. So that would be
still 6 games left if he plays Cincinnati and the rest.
So I would say 7 games.
Okay. First of all, your over under is set at 7 games. Your over under is set at something else because there's injury.
Oh, I think he's gonna play. I think he's gonna play in 7 games. But if I was trying to make this more interesting, given what you just said, I'll set it at 5.5.
I am laying a ton on the under on this. I think they've really had so many opportunities to put Carl Lawson in. The problem is Lawson doesn't really address their needs directly. Lawson is not a first and second down run stopping player, and they're short on outside linebackers. And you can see just from this last game, the guy they would replace Lawson for is Ojabo. And Ojabo is playing a bunch of first down snaps for them. And Lawson is going to be a pure situational pass rusher. I agree with your commentary there. I just don't think they have anybody else to take that role. So if they were to bring him in, almost like two things have to happen. Tavius has to come back, and then somebody else has to hurt. And then, So I think I actually think Lawson might play 0 games for the Ravens this year based on what we've seen so far. I think that would be
a fascinating development only because he had other potential suitors and clearly chose the Ravens. So I would be an unhappy camper if that were the end result of my choice, unless we won the Super Bowl. But I do think they're thinking. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
It's another case where they're evaluating it. They're watching practice every day. They know who Carl Lawson is, and they've obviously decided he can't help the team more than Ojabo can. And I can't. I have trouble believing it, and yet this is where we are right now. And Ojabo,
I think he's not in game shape. I think the issue is that he's not ready to play yet. I mean, you were at week 8 of the season, and he already wasn't on a practice squad somewhere.
Okay, there's a problem with your line setting then, saying he's going to play 7 games if you're saying he's not in game shape now, because unless we're right on the knife's edge of he's just crossing now the into game shapeness, you wouldn't believe that.
I think that's not unreasonable though. Like he played a full 15 games. He's just a guy that had no training camp, right, and was like working out at home and needs to. Well, the Ravens love their conditioning BS, right? Like needs to get up to snuff. And then once he crosses that threshold, I think he'll be active consistently.
All right.
They need another pass rusher, or they could. When it comes down to some of these big games, and maybe you're right, because like I could see them not feeling like they need to activate him against the Steelers, right? Like we can go heavy and we're not worried about how they're going to throw the ball.
It's more than that, Jordan. They just played 2 consecutive games with 3 outside linebackers and Lawson was available for both of them. And they said, no, we're okay with 3. And you can go back to the notion that, I mean, but in their hour of greatest need, they went to war with David Ojabo and 2 other guys at the outside linebacker group. That's unfathomable in terms of doing this.
Your logic here is very, very difficult compelling. To disagree with.
Yes.
And they've clearly made their choice regarding special teams in terms of like who they like to have on the active roster. So they would be going outside of their core of what they wanted. And we've seen other outside linebackers when they were more healthy be like see Ojabo left on that inactive list. So, you know, Lawson is going to have to show something. He was a guy with 5 sacks in 15 games last year, though. He's got a little juice in him. I think in the playoffs, we'd see him. I don't know how the practice squad works as it relates to the playoffs and whether or not he needs to be on the active roster by the end of the year or what.
Something tells me you get additional elevations or there's no limit on elevations or something like that for the playoffs, but I may be wrong. I may be wrong entirely.
I wouldn't feel like they needed it. They probably would feel like they might need him less against like Indianapolis or Denver, but more against Kansas City and Buffalo.
I think we're worrying too much about who Lawson might match up well if Lawson was who we thought he was 1 or 3 years ago, as opposed to who it is apparent Lawson is from the lack of ability to unseat Ojabo or be added as a 4th line outside linebacker in a game where you only have 3. I mean, it's so foreign to me that they would go to war without Carl. And then they did have other guys they wanted to elevate. So they really needed to elevate Keandre Jackson at safety. I think they could have lived without him. He's played well. He's played very well on special teams. No shade thrown on Keandre Jackson. But if you really felt like if that extra special teams player is more important than your fourth outside linebacker, that's a world I'm not really familiar with.
Unless they don't. And again, that's why I think it's non-game shape. Like if we do think that we're going to need to draw into the Lawson bag later, I'm not willing to risk him not being fully ready to be in a game and getting injured and tearing his Achilles as a result of it.
Okay, fair enough. I think Lawson is maybe another insurance policy's way I'd look at it. If they lost Draymond Jones at this point, if they lost Van Noy, heaven forbid.
I'll say such things, Ken.
Green was just hurt. Green might have predicated a Lawson activation. So.
No. I think the Cincinnati game is the watershed, right? Like if he plays in the Cincinnati game, then it was game shape and he just wasn't ready. And now we're going to see him active a bunch. If they don't put him on the field for that game, especially if Burrow's back, I think you're probably right.
All right. And I promised people we'd get to their questions. So we've dipped into about 30 minutes of this episode on pass rush, which is supposed to be in the first episode. Let's go into some individual player discussion. And Jordan, take us through the first guy you want to talk about.
I'm going to talk about Teddy Buchanan. And, Ken, you and I have not watched a game together yet this year, but he was a whipping boy for me for quite a minute. And I think for just cause. He just would miss a series of plays that you really would expect a guy that the Ravens have so much trust in to make, and then manage to keep his job when you saw guys miss lesser plays and be pulled out for what is equivalently more. I think Buchanan has really taken some big strides here in the last couple of weeks. It seems that he's gotten a better feel about where his depth on his drops needs to be. It seems like his tackling has cleaned up a lot more.
Yeah.
He's still not elite on that shed moment, which for a guy that is his size and his strength, you would expect him to be a little bit better at shedding. But if he's going to have the consistency in terms of tackling, like we've seen, and enough awareness that he's not the weak link from the passing perspective. Now, he might be the guy that's attacked and he might end up giving up more, especially against some of these elite offenses, because there's not somebody else to go after. So we're going to go after him until you make a decision to protect him. But I think his play has really improved over the last 3 weeks. It seems like there's a lot less reacting and a lot more just playing football. And we're seeing a lot of the core fundamentals result in that. And I think it's helped the defense tremendously.
Well, I'm very high on the up arrow of Buchanan from certainly where he was. He's taken a big step forward in coverage, and I agree he's been a better tackle. He had two defensive wins on three tackles in this game. There was a third that was wiped out by a holding call. So the Ravens actually got a holding call against Posick, I think, on the play. It was the one on Jenkins, whichever play it was. But anyway, it was a 1 yard gain that Buchanan had gotten the stop on, but they took a 10 yard holding penalty instead. He had kind of a tough zone assignment on that 26 yard pass that was over him and in front of Starks or Obuzie. I'm trying to remember who it was kind of between. There's a kind of a Bermuda Triangle of players involved there, but oftentimes the I know PFF will assign that to the underneath defender. I thought it was really a question of whose responsibility that was, but it was over him in zone. So you certainly could have given him that way, but I'm very happy with where he is as a player. He's helped the Ravens as a pass rusher. He's a good tackler that seems to engender trust in the players around him in terms of going as the second man in and being aggressive with the football. So 2 weeks ago, we saw both fumbles were cases where somebody else came in and ripped the football loose after he was making the tackle.
And he's a good example. You always talk about this concept, or you and I have talked about this a lot in a lot of different varieties of like a fail forward. He is, and the Ravens sometimes don't let their guys fail forward, but he is a guy that they gave him the latitude to do that. And we are seeing the return on that investment.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I know who I want to talk about, and I don't know if you'd pick him or not, but we'll go ahead and talk about John Jenkins, who he had a terrific game. He was really getting outstanding push in the middle of that line against the run. He was one of the reasons that they held the run down and got a lot of those barbelled results. He had one pressure himself, as I scored it. Two of his three tackles were defensive wins, but that the initial stop on third and one, There was good push in the middle, but I thought Jenkins had the best push, and Okoye ended up getting credited with the tackle. I'm not sure exactly how, other than he probably had his arms around the guy. But Okoye ended up getting credited with the primary on that tackle. But John Jenkins, it looked like, got the best push of the interior offensive line guys, and they had four defensive tackles on the field for that play. So really nice game. Also drew a holding penalty on Posick that we talked about earlier. Jenkins been a very underappreciated member of the Ravens this year. I think he's been very valuable, and he's a guy, you know, I think you think about bringing him back next year. It obviously, it's all dependent on money, what he'll play for, but if he wants to play for a similar amount next year, I think you do it.
Yeah. I don't see, unless the Ravens find a big defensive tackle that they like as an undrafted. And that's a position the Ravens have had success. They've gone out and find undrafted guys and been willing to play them early to be able to do that. But Jones has been really good, and I'll tie my next pick into why Jenkins has been so valuable for the Ravens, which is that he has allowed Travis Jones to do a lot more, that he doesn't play. Mm-hmm. And we saw before Travis Jones got hurt last year, played really well when, you know, Michael Pierce could be absorbing some of that same load, and they weren't asking Travis Jones to do that. Jenkins is doing that now. I don't think at the same level that we were getting from Michael Pierce, but certainly more than the baseline level of what you could get out of some guy doing this. And it's allowed Jones to be really good.
Okay, so I see a differentiation in the two ways. So Pierce and Jones were basically never on the field together. Now, I'm not saying absolutely never. There are a handful of plays. There are certainly some jumbo packages where they run together. But Jones was almost always paired with Matabike last year, which, by the way, also does improve what Jones can do on the field. But this is different this year. This time they're playing 1-3 with two nose tackles. And when they do that, and Travis Jones is the guy at the three tech, and Travis Jones is the designated pass rusher now for the interior offensive line. He's the one guy they have on the field on pretty much every single dime package. He sat out one in this last game. He played 17 of the 18 dime snaps. But they use him to basically go against the three tech when they have Jenkins on the field at the same time. And him and Jenkins are a fairly common combination as well. That makes Travis Jones a lot more potent. And we saw a good amount of that against Minnesota in terms of him really having probably the best game of his career to date.
But he's looked, he didn't have as great of a game overall as Cleveland, mm-hmm. against Cleveland, but he had the one play where his pressure, was it Gabriel or was it Sanders at that point? His pressure forced a quicker throw in the red zone. You see him shedding tackles. I mean, the guy's just throwing, like, he's just ragdolling guys all over the field all the time.
Well, he had it wasn't an on-time pressure, but he had a late pressure that was really important. So I wouldn't have counted it as a pressure, but that was the overthrow of Bond in the end zone for what would have been the game tying score. Yeah. That was huge.
Yeah. So it also kind of like took the light out of the tunnel for Sanders to be able to have that look, right? Like, he got big in front of him and he created the pressure. Sanders wanted no part of Travis Jones falling on top of him in that situation. And I don't think he was going to be able to throw it around him anyway. So, I mean, Jones is just such a critical, especially with Matabike out, he's such a critical part of what this defense needs to do. And even if it is a situation where he's drawing a ton more attention, which he did in this Cleveland game, like, so be it. That is part of what makes some of these other pressures that are from these extra blitzers and the simulated stuff work, because you commit two guys every play to blocking Travis Jones, and you have got four guys and a running back left to block whatever's coming at you.
I'm right there preaching it with you in that sense. I think the entire Ravens pass rush runs through Travis Jones. He's absolutely the heart and soul of it. And that's what makes him, frankly, the guy that the Ravens need to sign. If they can only get one of the big three, he's the one they need to get. If you look around the rest of the league, has already got Travis Jones as solving their interior defensive line problems. And a lot of teams have problems on the interior defensive line. They don't have one guy. And the Ravens, unfortunately, they had two guys. They really had three guys last year. That's an embarrassment of riches to have Matabike, Pierce, and Jones on the same team. There's a whole bunch of guys who don't have one guy on the defensive line, and they're looking at the draft and they're trying to figure out who they can sign. And they've all got the idea that they can sign either the, you know, Quinnen Williams, or they can get Dexter Lawrence, or now the in vogue name is Travis Jones, who he's going to be the hottest name, one of the really hot names anyway in free agency next year.
Yeah, he's going to be tagged if he doesn't sign.
He's going to be tagged
if they can't get a deal done. I think he'll be tagged.
Okay, all right.
I don't think he's the guy they won't let go.
You can tag likely. Okay, you can't tag Linderbaum for all the reasons that we know and we don't have to say. You can tag likely because the tight end position is pretty cheap. And you can tag, and then that at least staggers your problem at tight end. So you can solve it over a couple of years. So you don't have to, not the whole tight end room doesn't have to be redrafted all at once. And you could tag Jones, but you can only tag one, remember. So you can only use one franchise tag. So I'm not sure with the way they go. I mean, Jones is the more important player. I just don't know how much they're going to be able to sign him for. They think they can get him for him. I'll see if they can.
It's probably one of those situations where they put a deal in front of both guys and they're like, look, we're going to tag one of you. Whoever signs first gets more guaranteed money.
I mean, and that's probably true for all three of them right now, is they've probably made an offer to each of them. Travis Jones, he may be laughing at the offer for all I know, and likely already rejected an offer before he got hurt, apparently. And Linderbaum, they had negotiations, but now they're saying they're far apart. So if they're not with
you, and you can only do that gambit with two people, right? Like, you can't have a one of you three take it, and we're going to tag the other when you can only tag one person.
Well, if you're talking about the tag as an additional threat, I don't think you need it. I think you just need the carrot in all cases and saying, hey, look, we don't have an unlimited amount of money. We're offering you this, and we've got other contracts offers up. Give us an answer as soon as you can. That's the simple thing you can do. And that's what the baseball does in the draft. So a team will draft, like, say, 8 pitchers among 10 picks between rounds 11 and 20. And they'll say, okay, we're not going to sign all these guys because our total signing pool is not large enough to do so. But we can try and make the deal to 3 different pitchers, and we're fairly ambivalent. But we'll make our 11th round guy we're offering $1 million to, and our 13th round guy we're offering $850,000 to, and our 15th round guy we're offering $750,000 to. And those guys have to be quick on the draw if they want to get signed. There's only going to be one deal, is what the prosecutor will say to the not prosecutor, right? It's the police say to guys when they're questioning.
Yeah. So. Well, I think a guy like likely would maybe fear the threat of the tag. That if now he gambled on himself, it didn't pay off, I got to get a deal done. Because if then they go and sign Jones to this mega deal because they want to make sure that he's under contract, and they tag me and I have another bad year, and they draft a tight end behind me in the 4th round, which is exactly where I was drafted, and the Ravens are great at developing tight ends out of the 4th round, and they're going to sign Kolar for a 3-12 deal, and he's going to be the second tight end, and the Ravens are happy with that, I might be in trouble. So you have a little bit of leverage there, potentially, with him. I think Jones it's either we get a deal done at the right number, or we're going to tag you.
Okay. All right, well, I hope that they consider it, because I think he's awfully important. I'll move on to another player. We've got to talk about Keon Martin in this game. And I don't have to talk for too long, because we talked a little bit in the first episode, but Keon Martin played 18 snaps, all the dime snaps. They only allowed half a yard per play when he was in there, 9 yards on 18 plays. Keon Martin had 4 drive-ending plays in a 5-drive sequence. We did this. The only other player I can think of has ever done anything close to that in terms of success within the dime defense and also being the 6th defensive back on the field is Anthony Levine at Pittsburgh in 2018, when he took over the game in the 4th quarter, had 3 straight drive ending plays. And that year, the company, it might've been PFF actually, or it might've been Next Gen or one of the other companies, was accumulating quarterback hits, passes defensed, and other plays that had occurred on third down, I think it was. Might have been third or fourth down that they accumulated. And Anthony Levine.
Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's changing the game, Mood.com. They created an entirely line of functional gummies, 100% federally legal THC blends, discreetly delivered right to your doorstep. And here's the best part. You can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with the promo code Ravens. Now, I've tried a bunch of their gummies myself. Each one's totally unique. The Sleepy Time gummies knock me out right away. They help me unwind fast, leave me refreshed the next morning. The Epic Euphoria gummies, they're perfect for when your day just isn't going the way you want it to go. What makes Mood special is how they pair the THC with natural herbs and adaptogens. You won't find blends like this at any local shop. They've got gummies designed for focus, relaxation, clarity, even energy, all made from cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. No pesticides, no shortcuts, just high-quality weed you can trust. Plus, Mood backs everything with a 100-day satisfaction guarantee. So head on over to mood.com, check out their amazing selection, and don't forget to use the promo code RAVENS at checkout to save 20% off your first order.
No one plans for hair loss, but through Hims, you can take the next step with confidence. Access treatments made with clinically proven ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil to stop hair loss and regrow hair in 3 to 6 months. No waiting rooms, no hoops, just ingredients with a track record of results. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hims brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatments that put your goals first. For simple online access to personalized and affordable care for hair loss, ED, weight loss, and more, visit hims.com/Hail Mary. That's hims.com/Hail Mary for your free online visit. hims.com/Hail Mary. Individual results may vary. Based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Prescription required. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
This, like, after Aaron Donald was like second in the entire NFL in such plays. And I said, well, why don't you add Anthony Levine to that list? And they said, no, he hasn't played enough snaps. Well, if a guy hits 65 homers in 300 at-bats, would that be a problem for you? You know, it's just like, didn't make any sense, you know, what their argument was. And he said, no, it's not intended for players. Well, why not? So anyway, and that got Levine to chime in too, by the way, which was pretty cool.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, what's wrong with that? So anyway, Keon Martin, fantastic game. It's now two really top games in a row. My favorite Keon Martin play from this game was him going in on a slot blitz off the offensive left side, skying in the air. He went air Jordan, and you're never supposed to do that. As opposed to, you run through the quarterback's midsection. You do not go up in the air to try and take it. But it was perfect for Jadur in that situation because that was the strong side of the football field, which had three of the receivers on that play. And he basically took those off and waved Jadur. Jadur says, what do I do with the ball now? He brought it down, and then he got hit by – was that Hamilton sack or no? I think it was the, oh, now I'm missing out on this. It was the later sack for minus 14 by, it, no, it wasn't Martin there. It had to be the Hamilton sack, didn't it? Or he had to throw it away. Oh no, interception maybe. It might have actually been the interception because he didn't get a pressure on the play. So I'm not finding it on my score sheet. Because he jumped up in the air. But it was my favorite play of Martin's in the game was that one. I think people will probably remember what I'm talking about. But it was against Sanders. It was in the second half.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about Martin a lot. I mean, he did everything that he's supposed to do. If we keep seeing that, it's a huge value add for the Ravens. It's going to let them rotate their corners. It's going to be able to keep everybody healthy.
4 years of cheap cornerback play. I mean, this is like finding a, you know, some denomination larger than a silver dollar in the sand here.
I mean, it gives you a choice down the road about what you want to do with Marlon Humphrey, right? Like, and I think Marlon Humphrey has gotten a little bit of a bad beat this year overall, and people calling him done. I don't think he's done, but it gives you options down the road that if you feel like he is, that value add, right? We were talking earlier about the salary cap, being able to get Humphrey and a series of guys off the books, it could make a big difference.
Yep. All right. Who's your next guy?
I'll take Trenton Simpson, who doesn't play a lot, but has always seems to be flashing right now every time he's getting on the field. And really the one big thing that I will say about Simpson is whether or not the Ravens are going to give him a shot at playing outside linebacker. I think we've seen him be effective rushing the passer. We've seen him he's fast. We know he's fast. We know he's got some pass rush moves, not elite pass rush moves, not like Micah Parsons. But if the Ravens need to dig into the barrel and they need a guy that's going to take some of those snaps, he's a strong guy who has been flashing, makes a lot of plays on the other side of the line of scrimmage. He's a guy that I would like to see him get more snaps in some way or another. I don't know how the Ravens figure out how to do that, but I would like to see him get more snaps.
Yeah, he's played 29 snaps during this four-game winning streak, which is not much. He just played his lowest snap total of the season with 5, and he was outstanding. You know, he had 2 big quarterback hits. One of them was a 15-yard intentional grounding. He's playing some very good football, and the Ravens, they don't seem to be willing to go entirely to a Simpson and Jones dime where they move Simpson around as a kind of a floating pass rusher. They're not putting Simpson on the edge. That'll never happen. Not unless it's emergency, get me through the game kind of situation that they would do with who was the guy last year? Malik Harrison. But he's not big enough for that. But he is a guy who you can use in this floating pass rush role. And they did a wonderful job. And it's actually a perfect fit against, you know, lesser experienced quarterbacks who have trouble, you know, picking up where a blitz is going to come from, or lesser experienced lines for that matter.
Well, he could play the edge in a clear passing down.
Nope. Too small. Even then, it's too small.
You could wide nine him easily.
Okay. That's different. And if you're going to float him, you're almost like giving him the opportunity to do that as well. But
Miles Garrett isn't, he rushes out of the wide nine half the time.
Okay, I'm just going to say there's no situation where I want Simpson being locked in to go against a tackle. There's no situation where I want that. I don't think that's a winning move. I think there's lots of ways to get Simpson involved in stunts and games and twists and pick plays and all sorts of things. But there's the one thing I do not want to see is Simpson going up directly against a tackle. I think that's a losing proposition. So that's my problem.
I think he's a good pass rusher. He's got good bend. He's got good speed. The Ravens, when they need to, I wouldn't hesitate. I don't have the same take, but I respect your reasoning.
Fair enough. Okay. Let's see. You came up with Simpson. We got to talk about Kyle Hamilton before we let this game get away because he was outrageous. There's just no one who has an answer for him as a pass rusher, which is really cool. The sack, incredible spin move against Ford, the running back, got a forced fumble at the end of it. He also, if you missed it, he got a forced fumble after the whistle was blown on that tackle of Gabriel earlier in the game, which was beautiful. He set a pick for Van Noy on the stunt. He had 2 passes defensed. He was pissed off at himself for not getting the second one, kicked the football. We've seen that kind of behavior in this town from other star players, notably number 8, in terms of doing some stupid things with kicking the football. So this was a dumb thing, and he got a DOG for it. But you have a little more tolerance with a player like Kyle Hamilton does that. He had 4 defensive wins, 3 drive-ending plays that he made a contribution to. And one of his really nice plays was making that shoestring tackle of Sanders in the open field, about a 5-yard play. But Sanders could have gone for some decent yardage on that play. And he comes up with his arm dangling down. It does leave that question open. Is the durability a concern for where he plays now on the Ravens defense, given the style of play he uses?
I mean, my thing is, we've seen him play in these places before. The durability has generally been fine. The value add that you're getting from him playing in this space has been tremendous. And we've seen other guys that are other safeties play in the box a ton and not have durability issues, right? So it's a durability issue when it becomes a durability issue. And so far, he's, for the most part, played through all these little small maladies, which are going to happen for anybody that's playing inside a lot. I mean, Roquan missed some time, right? Like, this is when you're playing that many many snaps that close to the line of scrimmage, things are going to happen. So you have to be willing to accept that. I think the value add that you're getting from this, I mean, Hamilton adds a ton on the back end as well, but he's adding more at the line of scrimmage for right now. And quite frankly, without a better pass rush, they need it. So whether or not, we can't ever know whether or not he'll be durable enough to handle this until we get to the end of the season and find out if he's durable enough to handle it. I'm not willing to take the chance when we need to win nearly every game that we have left. Yep. not to put him at the line of scrimmage.
Well, and I'm with you. He's been the difference maker as well. By the way, Dr. Syed asked that question. Hi, Ken. Kyle Hamilton has a truly amazing game, but also seemed pretty banged up by the end of it. I know injuries can't be predicted reliably. but would you consider moving him back off the line of scrimmage for a game or two, perhaps rotate others in his place?
Not a chance.
You play the hand you're dealt. You try and win with it. I'm in the same spot as you on that. But thank you, Dr. Syed, for the questions. Always good stuff. We have another one from you coming up in the mailbag a little later. Why don't we call it there for players? I mean, we didn't talk about Draymond Green. He led the team in pressures this game. If you got anything to say about him, jump right in.
Yeah, no, I just think he's been a great addition. He was exactly a part of exactly what the Ravens needed. So,
okay, we have others, and it's Draymond Jones, not Draymond Green, which I think is what I said. But
I knew what you meant.
You knew what I meant. Oh, and I got to talk about Chidobe Awuzie, who is fantastic in this game. Absolutely fantastic. He's allowed only 5.7 yards per target this year. Somehow, the Ravens keep finding these cast off corners who can really help them. And Awuzie is a guy they're paying the vet min to. I mean, Tennessee is basically paying him for the Ravens, which is absolutely hilarious that Tennessee released a player of Awuzie's quality, you know, and thought, oh, this isn't a guy we need. And the Ravens pick him up, and one organization's trash is another's treasure. And Awuzie has been fantastic for this team. Ronald Darby in 23 was a hell of a player. Then he goes somewhere else and he's terrible. Again, so
yeah, you know, the thing I would say is it's interesting because sometimes the Ravens take a little bit of, like, as much as some of these front office people say that they are not listening to what everybody is saying out on the street, I think that they do.
Oh yeah,
it seeps in. And we know there was an interview that DaCosta did where he talked about Earl Thomas and how there was so much criticism around Ravens safety that they didn't do their diligence before they signed Thomas. He didn't commit to the fact that they wouldn't have signed him, like, not having done that diligence. So it might not have changed the outcome, but he said that they felt the pressure in that moment to add to safety. Earl Thomas was this elite guy. It was a fit for what the Ravens needed on the team. And so they made the leap because of it. Jair Alexander is the perfect example of the exact same thing, where me and many others were saying that Jair was a great fit for the team. Obviously an elite corner when he's healthy and when he's right mentally, and he's not one of those right now. And we don't know which, but he's not one of those right now. And doesn't have anything to add to the team. You talk about needing cap space, $4 million is not nothing. And I guess they got a 1.5 back. So $2.5 million is not a lot on the cap, especially as big as it is these days. But
I think it's $1 million they got back, because it was $2 million signing, $2 million base, and they had half a season left. At $2 million was $1 million. But even so, they got a 6th round pick, and even a 6 for 7 is basically a 6. That's pretty good value for who he was. Yeah,
but the cap space next year might be more important than a 6th round pick. $4 million in cap space or $3 million in cap space could be a big difference maker on the add-on to what you might need to do for a guy.
But he wasn't signed for next year. He was only signed for this year. So
no, but the cap will carry over. If they had not signed him and not signed anybody else, they had signed Awuzie before. I was like, oh, okay.
Okay, but it's $1 million for the saving for Jair for next year, unless you're talking about somebody else. And that's one player. I mean, that's all it is one player vet minimum.
I'm saying if they wouldn't have signed him at all, it would have been +3.
Okay, yes. Good point. True.
Yep, yeah, that's so. And you know, if they wouldn't have been able to squeeze a trade out of him, it would have been +4. And so just to say that the Ravens are good at picking these corners off the scrap heap to do what they need on the outside when they ask them of it. And then maybe they shouldn't feel the pressure to add guys like Jair Alexander at last minute when no one else wanted him before that either.
Okay, yeah, I should never make a universal generalization like that. I'll just say they have found some. They've swung and missed on Rock Ya-Sin. They swung and missed, obviously, on Alexander. So I'm happy to admit that. And also, you know, I dislike it when people talk about how the Ravens are their lottery tickets, and they'll give you a long list of all the 5th and 6th round players that didn't work out for the Ravens. Well, the Ravens have a higher hit rate than just about anybody on the 5th and 6th round. And the Ravens certainly have the only two teams that are even in the same league as the Ravens are the Packers and the Steelers in terms of drafting over their entire history. And it's the same guys doing it. So it's not like you can say, literally, Ozzie and DaCosta are the two guys right in front of those draft cards with the big stack of draft cards. They have to turn in their pick. They're the guys.
So I'm just saying, trust. And this is all a pro Awuzie take. And yeah. which is that if you like a guy a lot, you know, and maybe they didn't like him a lot and he's just overperforming what they thought they were going to get out of him. But he was yeah. one of the early signings that the Ravens made in the offseason. You know, trust your guy sometimes and don't feel the pressure for some of these big names. Now, Lamar might have played a part in that. I know Jair and Lamar yes. are friends. And so I'm all like the Odell signing. I don't have any qualms with because I think that it was a Lamar signing. It was for Lamar and to make Lamar happy. Now, whether or not it worked out or not is a totally different thing, but they needed to get Lamar signed and it got done post Beckham.
I can't make a bad signing to make a good signing. So if you're telling me it was part of Lamar's contract, then we didn't overpay for Lamar. If you're telling me they signed Odell to make a Lamar happy, but they didn't really have to, they could have used a draft pick or they could have done other things or they could have.
I'm saying the first part of it. I'm saying that it was borderline conditional for Lamar to get it done.
Yeah,
that's my take. We don't have to agree. I don't know. You
infuriated
don't know, right?
Like, about the entire Odell Beckham signing, obviously. And
I know,
and,
I know.
It's not like he was even bad. It's just the amount was absurd.
It was absurd. I agree.
So let's get to the mailbag here. Got a few to get through, and I really want to get these, and we really appreciate people sending stuff to the mailbag. Use hashtag film study mailbag. Please put that in with your question. I know it takes a few characters. But please do that. And if you need to carry it over your question onto a part two, you can do that. But if you include that, it's a lot easier for me to find it for the show. And otherwise I might miss on it. Got a question from Baltimore Sports Jam. Says Minnesota had some success running the football and subsequently Cleveland had some success. I would say, did the Ravens make an adjustment to stop the run or did those teams just stop by choice? Take this one first. I'll give you my handle on it second.
I think the Ravens made an adjustment. It's borderline impossible that you see a team. I mean, right out of the gate, Cleveland was running all over Baltimore, and then all of a sudden, it was completely gone. And some of that is like gaps and run fits. The Ravens' run fits this year have not been great. And some of that is playing in the big nickel, putting Hamilton at the line of scrimmage, even if it's on the strong side. Like the run fits there is more complexity that comes with that. I can't tell you the adjustments because I didn't watch closely enough to see exactly what was bringing that, but it's almost impossible for me to believe that is not an in-game adjustment.
Okay, so we'll start with Minnesota. Minnesota, I think, was all game script in terms of why they stopped. They only ran the ball 18 times, but for, I think, 6.7 yards per rush. So it was like, I think it was 18 for 120. So they wouldn't have stopped if they hadn't have been messed up by game script. And there's two elements to that. One is losing in the football game, which they weren't for the whole time. But the other thing was they were piling up the false starts and getting themselves into first and 15 non-running situations or second and 15 non-running situations. And those were cases there. With Cleveland, it is hard to say because I think they probably should have really tried to actively run the ball out in the second half. If one winning strategy for this game for Cleveland might have been to just say, we don't really believe the Ravens can catch up no matter how many drives they have against our defense. We've been too effective against what Lamar has shown us so far. We'll keep punting the ball to them. And even if it means, you know, doing it, and they could have really reduced their passing even more. Obviously, with Shadur out there, any reduction to passing would have been a good thing. We can fairly say that. But they first of all, they had the place where they had to pass at the end of the game where they were behind. So they had to change their thing. That's not that many plays, but there were 8 plays and they scrambled once for a run on those, but basically they had to pass on that last drive. The previous drive, they were 3 and out on passes. They didn't absolutely have to pass the ball then, but the Ravens had tied the game and they did need to have a score somehow. And they had no easy way to unlock that ability to score with Shadur in the game.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think all that's right. They went away from it for sure. And maybe they felt like they weren't going to win again running the ball. So that's part of why they went away from it. Again, this is one of those ones where you've got to really understand the technicals of football. You've got to be looking at where guys are lining up from a gap perspective, mm-hmm. what the packages are, what's happening behind it. It's a pretty heavy analysis if you want to try to identify a specific adjustment to stop a specific thing if it's not staring you right in the face. And the Ravens did not overcommit guys to the box. I thought what the Ravens were going to do was just load up the box and let their pass defenders, you know, try and go up against their, you know, their wide receivers and their tight ends and see what happened. And that is not how they approached it. So it wasn't dead obvious what the adjustment was, if there was one.
By the way, Baltimore Sports Champ, don't have an answer for your other questions, which is why the Ravens uniform pants appear to be perforated and see-through in the back. I did notice it during the game that you could see white behind the black kind of the pants. I don't know the reason for that. There probably is something in terms of making the breathable or whatever, but I have no idea if it's league wide or not. I don't know if even they have to get their uniforms approved by the NFL. They probably do in terms of only being of certain types of material. I do know that every NFL team keeps a tailor on staff who can make, and maybe more than one, to make uniform changes as needed. Like a lot of, in particular, used to be linemen like to wear a jersey that's much too small for them. So offensive linemen can't get a handful of jersey easily. A guy who played Burt, who was a tackle for the Giants in the 80s, was notorious for wearing a shirt that was just much too tight for him. But anyway. All right, let's move on to another one. I got another Dr. Syed question. Ken, second question. According to snap counts posted by Jeff Jerebeck, TJ Tampa had zero snaps and the defense was essentially special teams only. Has he been leapfrogged by Keon Martin at this point? The UDFA is playing so well, so I do get it. Okay, it's a matter of position they play. So Tampa is an outside corner and Keon Martin is a slot corner. So Keon's role is very closely defined as being the slot corner in the dime package, but he never plays on the outside, or at least he has not yet. And I don't even know, maybe Keon Martin could supplant TJ Tampa on the outside, but Tampa has been the guy they've gone to first on the outside when they needed outside corners earlier in the year.
Yeah. I mean, right now Keon is playing so well in the slot. I don't know how you move away from him there. And so I think that maybe if there is an injury potentially, or I guess it's almost if there are two injuries, you would see his role rise. But given the number of guys that the Ravens feel comfortable playing on the outside right now, I think that it's Martin's spot to get the snaps given that situational kind of requirement that you were just talking about. When Marlon comes back, it only gets even more difficult for Tampa to get on the field.
Yeah. I mean, it is a question is, do you keep Humphrey on the outside of the field, or do you even try some three-way rotation with, or maybe some two-way rotation with Awuzie and Humphrey to basically try and keep those two guys healthy? I mean, you're going to probably play Wiggins every snap, I would assume. But I really wonder whether or not they try and do something to not have Humphrey playing 100 snaps, 100% of the snaps in the regular season, and maybe Awuzie too, because they're both could be injured, obviously. They're both older guys and four corners in this league.
And we've seen the Ravens rotate guys at corner before. Yep. So, you know, I'd be okay with that. We've seen Marlon already be banged up. He's a guy that teams are also picking on. So rotating these guys also will help with that, right? Like when they feel like they've got to go after a guy, then take that guy off the field. It makes it much harder to script and for them to make decisions about what they might want to do quite as easily if that's what they're doing.
Yeah, I think that was true as recently as last year with Trey White and Stevens, who's another player I didn't think about. But obviously the Ravens have shown a willingness to rotate, which should tell you something about what they really, how they really evaluate their interior offensive line, given the fact that they're not rotating. And so we don't need to go down that hole again. But Stevens was a guy who had particular characteristics that were different from what Trey White brought to the table in terms of Trey White being able to find the ball in the air a little bit better. So anyway, that's good. We got another question from Brendan Way here. It's on Keon Martin. With Keon Martin's emergence as a reliable slot corner, do you think they'll keep him there on future dime packages? Well, absolutely, until Humphrey is back. When healthy, I can potentially see Marlon staying on the outside while Keon can come in to fill that slot corner role. So it's true that Humphrey's slot corner role is basically taken away 100% of the time in any nickel snap with Hamilton playing at that slot corner role. So the question now is, do you banish or do you make Humphrey exclusively an outside corner and use Martin continually in that dime package as the slot guy?
I think you do, right? Like, especially if you're trying to rotate and you're trying to get different guys snaps, and like maybe Marlon is going off the field, maybe Awuzie is going off the field like we just talked about. But you're only going to get, especially if you're going to not use Martin on the outside, you're only going to get so many snaps out of him. And if you want to get him on the field to see what you're going to get from him, not just from this year, but into the future, then you got to let him play. right? And if you've got a guy that's being successful when he is playing, then you got to let him continue to play.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think they will make an effort to do it. I think that Keon Martin now is in the plans for the foreseeable future. And obviously a game where he gets beat for two plays and has a DPI as well, I mean, that could change things. But for right now, I think he's in very good shape. Glenn Smith has a question. He says, and this is really a comment. And this is fine, by the way. You can send us comments. We don't have to have them all be questions. Cleveland's last two wins versus Baltimore in 23 and 24, JOK, that's Owusu-Koramoa, the inside linebacker, had 14 tackles, four quarterback hits, 1.5 sacks. He says it's understated how he influenced Lamar Jackson decisions.
In those two games, the Cleveland Browns gave up an average of 27.5 points. They gave up 31 points in one of those games. The JOK has nothing. The Ravens did just fine and were well above league average in terms of scoring and performance in those games. He might be filling up the stat sheet, and good players do that, but he is not this Lamar. I know this offhand because I've seen this before, and it annoys me. JOK is not a Lamar neutralizer. Nobody in the league is a Lamar neutralizer when Lamar is 100% healthy. Now, the only thing that's going to neutralize Lamar is his offensive line playing like trash or Lamar not being fully healthy. And we've seen iterations of that before really be the problem. But JOK is not Lamar Jackson kryptonite. I'm not here for it.
Okay. All right, very good. Glenn, we appreciate your comment there. This is the fourth time that Lamar had a passer rating of 60 less in his career as a starter. The Ravens have won all four of those games. All
that's
four.
Wild. That is a crazy stat.
It is unbelievable, frankly. They have not needed. Okay, here's a good one. I like this one. Adam Minikowski says, just for fun, should Anders have gone down at the one-yard line? I know you're a proponent of that sort of thing. The Ravens' red zone woes and Cleveland's offensive ineptitude may change the equation, but just curious. So it's not an illegitimate question, by the way, at all. And I was thinking about it after he scored. I'm thinking, you know, would it be better if he just went down here? But there were about 2.5 minutes left. So it wasn't a situation where they had time. I mean, Cleveland had the ball when they crossed the 2-minute warning. It wasn't a situation where the Ravens are going to be able to burn off a lot of clock easily. I forget how many timeouts Cleveland had left at that point in the game. They might have had two. So they're going to have to call one maybe before the 2-minute warning. Then they're going to call another. Then that's
after they had any. They didn't have any. I'm looking at this downs like play by play. And so it was eight plays. It was a kickoff, 25-yard pass, incompletion. 10-yard pass, no timeout, five-yard run, incompletion. Oh, yeah, there was the double timeout at the end.
They had one. And that was timeout number two by Cleveland. So they had two timeouts at that
point. Also, they had one that they never used.
Yeah, the one they never used. So they had two timeouts. And so they would have had to use one presumably right then as they went down because they'd realized the Ravens were trying to run out the clock on them and not let it get down to 2 minutes. If they did let it get down to 2 minutes, then the Ravens, they wouldn't, I don't know that they'd exactly take a knee, but they'd try and keep the ball at the exact same spot. And you can't do that by spiking the ball. You have to do it by kneeling the ball. So there'd be some difficulty in terms of doing it. The time that it really mattered is 10 years gone. It's Christmas night, 2016, when they had the opportunity to do it and they could have won the ball game that way. But this game, I think it would have been an unnecessary risk. I think that basically they put the ball in the end zone. They went up by seven. I didn't think there's any chance Shadur was going to drive him down the field. But the one fear that I had was that they would go for two if they did do that. So if they somehow got in the end zone, they were going to go for two and the Ravens are going to have no say in the outcome of the game.
Yeah. So they would have gotten it down to what? 120, right? Because no, they would have gotten it down to
lower
40. Because they would have gone to the 2-minute warning, and then that would have been
the 2-minute warning. Before, they wouldn't have gotten to until after at least one play,
right?
And then they still could have called another timeout, and they would have gotten it. Would have been third down at the 2-minute warning, and that would have been all their timeouts gone.
Okay, so okay. 120.
Yeah, and then they would have, and no, because they would have had to score on third down. You'd say, right? And if they had to score on third down, then that's only going to take 5 seconds off.
Oh yeah, then it's okay. Yeah.
So it's, I don't think it was a situation where they really had a chance to do it. But
I was thinking about it as a straight kneel to kick for time purposes. Not even attempting the touchdown was where my head was.
Okay. And so if they did a straight kneel and a kick, then they could have taken a 3-point lead with 1:15:10 to play.
Yeah,
that would not have been good.
That would not have been good enough because they got to the 25 in 1:40, and they didn't use a timeout to get down there. Like their timeout came after they had an incompletion. So hindsight here being 2020, that would have been a really bad decision.
Yeah, I would have.
they would have been able to kick the field goal.
I mean, even Shedeur Sanders, I'd be concerned about him making a play with his legs or his arm that could get him in. I mean, he's a super high variance player. I wouldn't trust that the Ravens would be able to get it locked down for that period of time as well as they played in that second half.
Also, I don't think it crossed. You know how teams like prep for these moments where they need know whether they should go down and that's the situation. I don't think that there was any part of the Ravens' preparation for that play that they thought that Mark Andrews on the power lead was going to run it into the end zone.
I don't think they thought about that. You're right. And they may or may not have had their code word in the huddle. And Harbaugh talked about that, by the way, at camp this year. But I don't know if they had their code word in the huddle that they would have, had Geronimo or whatever it means, don't score. They would have had that in there. I don't think they did. Let's put it that way. I think they were happy taking the touchdown.
There is a iconic picture of Mark Andrews, Ken, right after he scored the touchdown, like doing some move. And there's a picture of Schweisinger, who I think is a great player and is going to have a great future in the NFL. Remember the Joe Flacco where he was chasing, he was chasing like a Houston guy on a touchdown return where the Ravens lost like 40-10. Like this was like decades
2012.
Ago.
2012.
Yeah. Almost decades ago. And he's like laying face down flat out. There's a picture where Schweisinger is doing that in like on like the 3-yard line and like Mark Andrews is posing. Is a great photo. So anyone go try and find it.
Yeah. By the way, Charlie Kolar had some problems blocking in this game, but he made a great combination block on that play. He hit a great seal at the line of scrimmage. They got up to level 2 and he contacted Schweisinger and really slowed him down. And I don't think there's a reason. Neither of those guys are particularly fast, though Andrews supposedly hit 20 miles an hour on the gun or what the chip measurement. I don't think there's an obvious reason why Schweisinger should be able to outrun Mark Andrews at their relative ages right now.
Yeah. Don't disagree.
All right. It's a little more for AngeLove85. He says, also, how do you feel we match up defensively against Cincinnati and the Steelers?
The Steelers, I think we match up great against.
Just fine.
The Steelers' offense is terrible. Cincinnati is just a bad matchup for everybody. I mean, when Ja'Marr Chase is on the table and they're willing to sling it at him 20 times, if he's not spitting it in somebody's face or not throwing a temper tantrum, he can go. We've seen it. He can go off for 350 yards if he wants to. He is that talented, and there's no matchup that can take that away, and it can require a lot. That being said, their offensive line is not great. Their running game is not great. If Burrow is not back, their quarterback situation is not great. So I think we match up just fine given the current lay of the land. Joe Burrow could be one of the like distorting factors to that, but quite frankly, the Ravens have handled Joe Burrow really well in their history.
Yeah. They forced the ball out quick very well. And having Kyle Hamilton playing where he is against Joe Burrow is a big, big advantage. Also, they're going to be here on a short week. That's a positive thing. The Steelers, I'm with you. I don't think the Steelers have a bunch of offensive weapons that I'd be concerned about. Probably I'm more concerned about what the Steelers might be able to do them in the run game than what they can do with the passing game now. And a lot of Mason Rudolph's game is on screens. It's interesting, by the way, I've been reading the Pittsburgh boards for a little bit of amusement today and last night, and they had some talk out there about the Chase spitting incident. And they said it was perpetrated on our guy. Shouldn't we have some say about when that suspension is put in play? And the truth of the matter was, it might be a case where, they get spat in the face and the Ravens get the benefit because he doesn't play against them. So it could be really funny in that regard. So I actually can see that point, by the way, But that's not the way life works.
No, it's not. But that would be downright hilarious. Also, just offhand, I can't believe that Cincinnati would let Burrow come back and even play this year.
They won't.
Given the way, where their record is. It would be criminal, and I can't see Mike Brown letting Joe Burrow play, given the amount of, like, that guy cares about his money more than just about how anybody else in the world cares about their money, and a lot of it's tied up in Joe Burrow. But if they let him come back and play against Baltimore, what you saw in the second half against Sanders, that is what you're going to see all game, because Joe Burrow is not going to be able to move.
Well, they have to be able to make sure that Joe can't get out his on-time throws to Ja'Marr Chase. And Cleveland didn't have a weapon like that, and they didn't have a quarterback that could execute it, even if they did have a weapon like that, even if Jerry Jeudy were exactly who Ja'Marr Chase is. But I agree. I think that they will try and pressure Burrow. I think the very first thing they'll do is they'll go after him, and they'll see what he can do. They've had good success with Burrow over the years, and they've had great success with Cincinnati defense and scoring a lot of points against him. All right. Outstanding stuff. So thanks so much. Oh, we ought to do our 3-2-1 MVPs. We didn't do that. I know we're at 220 now, but let's do it real quick.
Like Draymond Jones as my third star, okay. Like bronze medal guy. The pressure is what the Ravens need. They need a guy on the edge and can, like, move to the interior or something and create some pressure that's not Travis Jones.
Love it. And the pressure he got on Teller, you saw how upset Teller was about the hands to the face. Didn't look bad to me. The key thing was he didn't push his helmet up.
And he looked so upset, and it did not look that bad.
Yeah, it really did. He might have like had a chokehold on him or something, but you could see his arm is extended and it's up in the kind of the throat or high pad area, but Teller was really upset about it. My number three guy's Chidobe Awuzie, fantastic. Impact on the end of this game with the PDs, allowed, I think it was another 15 yards on three targets or something. It was low. Another great game for him. Number two star?
We agree on the three star, or?
I know you said Draymond, and I said Awuzie.
Oh, Awuzie. Yeah. Yeah. So my second guy is Awuzie. I thought they need that guy on the outside. Martin's didn't stand out to me as much, and I'm bearing the lead on who my one-star guy is, but everybody knows who it should be. I think the Ravens need a guy that can show up on the outside. Wiggins had a good game, and he had the interception on the flashy play, but Awuzie just played a really good game.
Okay, I completely agree. I think Martin's impact on this game was greater, though, because of the four drive-ending plays he participated in. Just the impact of that is enormous. It's so much leverage involved with Martin's snaps in particular. Now, Awuzie is out there for those snaps too. I almost made Martin my number one guy, but Martin is my number two guy for this game. He's played two fantastic weeks of football in a row. I'm very excited about the prospects going forward. And number one guy?
Kyle Hamilton.
Okay. All right. Mine too. I thought I would make Martin the number one guy, but there's just no way. Kyle had too many total contributions in this game to overlook what he's done. And it's been the whole season to have him move back to slot corner, which is why both of us are, damn the poor torpedoes, full speed ahead with both of his shoulders.
Elbows, yes. All of it, yeah. Whatever.
all his joints are in play right now. No, seriously, we don't make fun about health issues, but seriously, his play at slot corner is driving the Ravens defense right now. All right, Jordan, thanks so much again for coming on. Always a pleasure to talk football. We always get in these great, high-pitched debates about these various elements. We go way long, but tell folks where they can talk football with you online.
Yeah, you can find me on Discord, Flash Jordan K, Jordan without the A. Got a good group of guys talking football over there. Anytime you want to message me, would love to chat with you.
All right. Outstanding. Other folks out there, please keep the questions coming into hashtag film study mailbag. Show this podcast to one new person and help. It's an older guy. Help them just listen to it off the website. Old guys don't want to deal with podcasts. They don't understand podcast players. Too complicated. Just show them how to play it directly off their desktop, because they probably don't even have a laptop. And I know I'm that guy, so I'm not putting down that generation. I want them as customers for the podcast, as consumers, and appreciate all of you out there, and the quality of the audience, absolutely terrific. I appreciate it every week when I'm writing and when I'm thinking about what to say on this pod. Jordan, thanks again for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Ken.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
Hey, it's Austin James. Yes, I'm living with diabetes, but it doesn't have to define me. Thanks to the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor, I get real-time glucose readings throughout the day. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor is small and easy to wear, giving me the freedom to focus on my life as a parent and a musician. Now this is progress. You can get a free sensor at freestylelibre.us.
Offer available for people who qualify. Visit myfreestyle.us to see all terms and conditions. Certain exclusions apply. Data on file, Abbott Diabetes Care, for prescription only. Safety info found at freestylelibre.us.